This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And we are having glorious weather again. I am so happy that the cold weather has passed us because I don't like it. I don't care that I am a youper and I was born in a blizzard, which actually happened on March 28th. So all of you people up north, you might still have a blizzard. You never know. But I do want to say that I don't like cold weather, and I'm happy that we are now warming up down here. I want to thank everyone. I just celebrated the third anniversary of Joy on Paper, and I want to thank all of you who sent in lovely emails to me and messages on Facebook and Twitter. Particularly those who sent it on Facebook. Now, I know Facebook today. It's funny. Finally, I decide to do Facebook. I've put it off for 2 years or 3 years because I just don't have the time for it. And so when I decide to do it, all Facebook collapses on the stock market. But the truth is, Facebook serves a wonderful purpose from a business point of view, from a point of view of reaching people. It's just, all you have to do is be careful not to put your personal information on. To use Facebook as a way to communicate and to talk to people about what you're doing, what you're writing, what you're reading, this is a wonderful use of Facebook. I would just say, don't put personal information on. That's simple. It's real easy. And use it as a tool for communicating and getting to know people and to get to know your community. So I am encouraging you to go to Facebook and like me. It's Radio Joy on Paper, because no matter what they say, and you'll see the stock will go back up and they'll have ups and downs. Businesses use Facebook a lot, and they need Facebook as a way to reach customers. So it is not going to go away. And in fact, advertisers look at the number of friends you have on Facebook, etc., from a business point of view, whether you're an author or doing a radio show or whatever. It makes an impact. So I do appreciate anyone who went onto Facebook and liked me and continue doing it, because, as I said, Facebook is not going to go away. And it is a wonderful tool from a business point of view. Just keep your private stuff private. There's too much sharing of private information, if you ask me. Now, I also want to tell everyone that there have been so many things happening in the writing world. And one of the things that's happening right now, and this is the Writer's Digest contest for indie authors. If you are an indie author, entering a contest that is relevant and that is important to literary agents is one of the best things you can do to promote your book. So go to readersdigest.com. The contest is open until April 2nd. You can submit your book if you self-published. The prize, of course, is $8,000, a trip to New York, and all sorts of wonderful goodies, including lots and lots of books. So it is a way, as Nancy Peacock discovered, she self-published in 2014. Her book went nowhere. Then she won the Writer's Digest Award in 2017, and she got a major publishing deal. So that can happen to you if you get noticed by the right people for the right contest. So again, I highly recommend the Writer's Digest contest. And also coming up, not quite, the deadline's not yet, but it's the San Francisco Writers Conference. And this is the second contest that I think is of relevance to literary agents. You have to remember, literary agents get hundreds. I mean, some agents get as many as 400 queries a week. So they have a lot of things they have to plow through. one of the things that really helps them is when they do see somebody winning a contest, and they, it opens their eyes, and they say, okay, well, we'll have a look at this author, because if they want a contest that is judged by important people in the industry, I'm talking people who have many years of publishing experience, which reminds me that there are quite a few scams out there that indie authors are getting, and I want you to be very careful about giving your book or anything away, and especially money, to the scams that are coming through the internet. But right now, I'm going to go to an interview. I taped it last week when I had a sore throat. I'm better today, but it is a fascinating interview with one of the most intellectual people I've ever spoken to. And his name is Yaron Brook, and he is the head of the Ayn Rand Institute. And you can find out more about Ayn Rand at AynRand.org. For many of us, perhaps one of the defining moments in our life was reading The Fountainhead. Ayn Rand's book has changed the life of many people and opened the eyes to so much. And so I was particularly thrilled to be able to talk to Yaron Brook. And I'm going to go straight to that interview right now. Okay? Are you there?
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you on. First, I have to say my husband wanted to say a special hello to you because he's also a graduate of the Technion, and so
wonderful.
And so we were thinking about that when I was talking about what you're going to talk to us today about. 75th anniversary of the publication of The Fountainhead. It's amazing, isn't it?
It is. It makes me feel a little old, but yes. The novel was published in 1943, became an instant bestseller by word of mouth, and it sells as many copies today as it did back then. So really a publishing phenomenon.
For all of us who became such fans at a young age of Rand, and we just devoured, of course, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, it made an impact on so many people. When I talk to people and you mentioned what is one of your favorite books, and The Fountainhead comes up, I would say, with at least 50% of the adults that, you know, people over like 40 that I've talked to, because it influenced them at some point in their life.
I think that's right. I think that it is a book that, if you read it, it has an impact on you. It's not a book that you can just walk away and shrug and pretend that you never read it, as so many books unfortunately are. It's a book that really resonates, and it leaves a mark, agree or disagree with much of the premises in the book. It really has a message, and it has an important message, and it presents real conflicts that one can identify in one's own lives. And it resonates with particularly young people who are looking for an ideal, looking, trying to figure out life for themselves, and here is a life lesson. In a wonderful novel, I think really a classical American novel. This is one of the American novels written since the founding. So, yes, it's still to this day, young people are heavily influenced and they're moved by The Fountainhead. I love the name of your show, Joy on Paper. Well, that's The Fountainhead. The Fountainhead is Joy on Paper, or digital material, as it might be today.
Yeah, exactly. That I was thinking of that when I thought of the book, because Rand had this kind of joy of life that one has to embrace it. One has to find that joy. One has to, for themselves, one has to make it. And so I thought it was actually, I was thinking about that this morning too, how appropriate that it would be about joy.
Very much so. I mean, Rand's whole philosophy is about making the most of your life. It's really a philosophy for the pursuit of happiness. And her characters in her novels, the heroes, are constantly pursuing their vision for the best life possible to them, using reason, using their mind to figure out how to live a great life, to be the best that they can be, to you know, and The Fountainhead in particular, Howard Rourke, the architect, the hero of the novel, it faces enormous odds professionally to conform. Everybody wants him to conform. Everybody wants him to compromise. And he won't. He stands up to them. And he takes a beating for that. It's hard. But in the end, he comes out victorious by sticking to his own independent thinking, by committing himself to his own artistic integrity. He wins, and he gets the girl in the end, and he gets to build the buildings he wants in the end. And it's such an inspiration, and it's such a model for how people can and I think should live.
One of the things, of course, Rand was born in St. Petersburg, Russia, and I live right here in St. Petersburg, Florida. So quite often, I'm driving past this building, and every time I pass it, I think of Rourke, because I think, oh, he would blow up that building so fast, because it is just an abomination. They took a beautiful area, a beautiful setting, and they made a mockery of the, you know, it's a VA hospital, and the actual old building is gorgeous, and then they made a mockery of the new building, and I thought, oh, he would come and blow it up, and I just wish, where's Howard Rourke when I need him? Because I hate driving down that street, because it's exactly somebody who just, oh, it's just an ugliness, and you always think an architect should see beauty, and it's amazing.
And so much about architecture today. I was in Denver, and I don't want to pick on Denver, but this is true of most of America. I was in Denver last week, and I'm driving through the suburbs, and these massive homes, what they call McMansions, they all look the same. They're all boxy, ugly, and no imaginations, no individuality, nothing to stand out. And I think, you know, this is the land of the individual. This is the land of people aspiring to do their own thing. And this is what we do when it comes to architecture. In Southern California, half of their homes are these Tuscan villas with tiny little windows, even though you've got magnificent views, imitating what they do in Tuscany, you know, 500 years ago. Who cares? Think forward, think new, think, adopt their architecture to your environment, to the weather, to the scenery, to the view that you might have. And that's how it works. That's Frank Lloyd Wright in terms of a real architect. That's many of the architects that we had in America in the past. And it seems like now everything is bland and gray and conformist and repetitive. Maybe that's a sign of our decline in spite of Ayn Rand's efforts to remind us of the beauty of architecture and the beauty of individualism.
I was thinking about Rourke when I can't reread this book again, because I have to read a lot of books, and I have read it so many times that I can't do it again, because now, since I've been doing this show. But it is so true that once you've read this, and you do look at buildings with a different eye because of her, because you say, wow, she's right. Why can't people just find that, the beauty and the joy in something? And you're right, building a house in California with little windows because in you did it in Italy hundreds of years ago is so silly.
When they didn't have air conditioning and they didn't want the heat coming in, they built little windows. But we have air conditioning now, so build big windows and look at the view and experience the outdoors and bring the outdoors in and all of that. I mean, it's such a waste and so sad. And, of course, it's in so much of the rest of our lives, you know, social media and everything else. It's just people are just becoming more conformist and more, tribal and collectivistic. And we're losing the beauty of the individual spirit, of the individual soul, and the individual creativity and individualism culturally. So, you know, I think Ayn Rand would be saddened by the state of America today from a cultural aesthetic perspective.
Well, she had so many ideas on so many subjects that it's impossible in a short interview to talk about all of them. But one of the things I've always, well, there's so many things I've wondered about her. What's your position is to really keep her ideas alive in the forefront, right?
Absolutely. It's to make her ideas part of the cultural debate. I think her philosophy is a groundbreaking philosophy, a crucially important philosophy for the world today, both in terms of individual happiness and individual success and in terms of politics. And it's for us, it's very important that people read her books because they inspire a certain joy of life and a certain confidence in living. And it, also her philosophical ideas, it's important that they be taught at schools and universities and that people at least confront them, you know, instead of ignoring them, which is what most academics do today, Ayn Rand. Confront them, challenge them, let's have a conversation. We think these ideas are good and they will win out. So, yeah, the goal of the Ayn Rand Institute is to keep those ideas in the forefront and to continue the debate about them.
Because it is important that the people just start thinking, because there is so much, well, we see this in our universities, where you can't talk about so many subjects anymore because everything has to be one way. And of course, she came from Russia, where she saw the bad things that were happening when people were forced all to think the same way.
Absolutely. I mean, I was recently attacked at a university because the students decided that mine was a voice they did not want to hear, or at least a tiny minority didn't want to hear, and they stormed the room and threw smoke bombs and set off the fire alarms and ended the event. And it's sad. It's sad that we're at a point in American history where we can't have a conversation. We can't use reason to debate and discuss and figure out what's true and what's not true. Instead, there's a faction within our culture, and I think this is a faction both on the left and on the right, that wants to silence opposition, that wants to silence debate, that wants things to be the way they say they have to be. And cram it down all of our throats. So again, I think this is part of this cultural collectivization, cultural conformity, and a lack of respect for human reason and for the independent mind, which is so important to Ayn Rand's philosophy and so important to Ayn Rand's novels.
And of course, she called it objectivism, which means, how would we best describe it? It's really the essence that man is heroic, and man, right?
Yeah, I mean, man is heroic, and he can use his reason to know reality and to be objective about the truth, that the truth is not what we pretend it to be. The truth is not made up. The truth is not a consequence of whatever you feel like it. The truth is objective. It is out there for you to discover, and the only way to discover truth is by using your mind, by thinking, by using reason. Emotions are wonderful, but they're not tools of cognition. And unfortunately, we are training our kids to emote, to feel, not to think. And civilization depends on thinking. Progress depends on thinking. Innovation depends on thinking. Beautiful architecture depends on thinking. And if there's one thing that Ayn Rand would say, how to live a good life, how to prosper, how to be successful in life, it's think. Use your mind to discover the truth, the truth about reality, the facts of reality, what is right and what is wrong, and live accordingly. And that is a message that I think is desperately needed in our culture and that young people desperately need.
Well, I think it's wonderful that you are doing this work of getting this book out to people, getting this book out to young people. And I know for myself, when I was young, I was at that sort of flirting with communism idea. You know, we all go through that, you know, and
sure.
One of the things that happened to me, I was actually at a protest, and it was so funny. Protesters were trying to put flowers in the guns of the National Guard, and it reminded me that protesters back in the Revolution of 1848 in Paris were doing the same thing. And I thought, okay, people, let's all stop here. Something, you know, if we're doing it now, we've sort of missed the boat. Something's not working here. And right there, at that very moment, I said, this is stupid. I said, this is so stupid. I remember that feeling that there has to be something more. You have to think more. And it was shortly after that that I read The Fountainhead, because, you know, I was young and I was 17 or 18. It has an impact.
I mean, I was a socialist. As most kids growing up in Israel in the 1960s and 70s, I was a socialist. It's all we really knew in those days. until I read Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, and it really changed my life. It inspired, it gave me purpose in life, it gave me an idea of how to live, and really gave me the backbone, in some ways, the courage to make my life my own and to live it for myself, for my own happiness, neither, you know, sacrificing for other people, but neither asking other people to sacrifice for me, really living an independent life, using your own mind as your standard. And that's what objectivism is about. It's about living a heroic life, making the most of your life. And, of course, the heroes in her book, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, really project that heroism. They project what is possible when people live by their mind, live by proper moral values. In The Fountainhead, she emphasizes integrity and you know, doing what you actually say you're going to do it, even if you suffer short term, the long term benefits far exceed any short term suffering, and really doing what you're going to say you do, sticking by your aesthetic moral values, and living the best life that you can live. That's what her book's about. That's what her philosophy is about. At the end of the day,
and you know, so often we talk about altruism. You know, people who talk about they want to give to others and they want to sacrifice for others, and I get rather cynical because I think so many of them actually benefit from this altruism. So
it's not pure, but that's the point. There is no such thing as pure altruism, and if there was, we would all suffer dearly for it. And Ayn Rand was a huge critic of the morality of altruism, the morality that says that your purpose in life is to serve other people, that their happiness is more important than your happiness. I mean, and so she completely turned that upside down. And she said, no, what's really important in life is your happiness, is living the best life that you can live for yourself. Does that entail helping other people sometimes? Absolutely, if it's consistent with your values and your goals in life. And if it contributes to your life, then absolutely help them. But that doesn't mean blindly helping anybody. And it means recognizing that your primary purpose in life is your own happiness. Your primary purpose in life is your own productive achievement, your own career. And then as a sideline, you know, charity or whatever it is, that's not what makes you a good person. What makes you a good person is living a good life, is you know, thinking for yourself, producing for yourself, making something of the one opportunity you have here on earth, making a mark, and it's in whatever way that you can. And charity is fine, but it's not what makes you a good person. What makes you a good person is what you do with yourself. It's what you do with your life.
Now, what philosophers influenced Rand? Was she deep into philosophy before she came out with her own philosophy?
She was. I mean, she searched all these philosophers because she wanted guidance, particularly in how to create the kind of hero she wanted to create in her books. And she found them all lacking. I mean, I'd say the biggest influence on her was Aristotle. She says that. And she would very much consider herself in the tradition of Aristotle. Aristotle's ethics about the pursuit of eudaimonia, the pursuit of human individual flourishing, is he viewed reason as the only way in which people learn the truth and know about reality. So in those senses, Ayn Rand was very much, if you will, a follower of Aristotle. And certainly some of her politics, you know, the idea of individual rights comes from John Locke, and you can here and there find ideas in other people. But really she found most philosophies, or all philosophies out there, lacking in describing her view of the ideal heroic man, her Howard Roark, her John Galt. She needed to create her own philosophy in order to write the kind of novels that she wrote.
It has been an honor to talk to you today, Yaron.
Well, a real pleasure. Thank you, Patsy.
Bye-bye.
Thank
now.
You. Bye.
Okay. We're just going to have a quick commercial break, and then we'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back, and I am just waiting to talk to somebody from England, and I always love to talk to people from England, and she is now one of my favorite authors, so it's going to be really an interesting interview with Claire McIntosh. But meanwhile, I do again want to remind you that if you have an author that you would like me to invite on Joy on Paper, just go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper.com, and I have a form, and you can fill it in there. You can tell me what author you would like me to interview, and if you are an author, you can tell me about your book, and I would be happy to have you on the program, because I love this opportunity to give to authors the opportunity and to talk to listeners and to tell them about your books, because, you know, it is not easy to promote books. There are so many books out there, but not enough places to promote them. So I am always happy to have new authors on to talk about their books. And while I'm thinking about it, I do want to remind everyone, I've been hearing a lot from people, and you know, how do you get to be a better writer? You get to be a better writer by reading. You have to read well, and you have to read carefully. It's not so much the quantity of reading, it is the quality of reading. Whatever your genre is, you should read, of course, in that genre, but also you should read other books that are just classics. And the reason they are classics is because they were well written. A well written book will last for 100 years, for 500 years. So it is up to you to teach yourself. There's nothing, there's no college, there's no internet, you know, workshop that you can do that is going to teach you to be a better writer. You actually have to do it yourself. It's like I was telling another author, it's like learning to throw a pot. When you are starting to work with clay, you are fooling around with it, you're throwing it, you're learning how to do it. The first bunch of pots never turn out. Some are bent, some are too thick, some are too thin. You have to just keep practicing. So I think I have an author on. I have an author now who has certainly practiced a lot, because she's a fantastic author, and I am so very thrilled always when I get an author whose books have really touched me in many ways. And so I am so happy to welcome to the program Claire McIntosh. Hi, Claire.
Hello. Hi.
Okay. Well, I am telling you, it is so wonderful to talk to you. One, because, you know, I've lived in England a number of years, and so I'm probably the only American that you're going to talk to who's actually been to Chipping Norton.
Really? Oh, yeah. How wonderful.
Well, when I was born in northern Michigan, but I read Jane Austen all my childhood. And so when I was 21 years old, I went to England and I bought a cottage in Sonning.
Wow.
Yes, a 400-year-old cottage. And because I wanted to be like Jane Austen. And so, you know, that's not far from Steventon, which she grew up. And not far from Chipping Norton. So I've been up there quite
a few
times.
That's wonderful. That's brilliant. How lovely.
It is. Well, you know, it is so amazing. There you were up there in Chipping as a police officer. Wow.
I was, yeah. For 12 years, I was a police officer.
Quite amazing. You went from police officer, writing those reports on people that you interviewed, into an absolutely fabulous, fabulous author. I have to tell my listeners, it's so wonderful. Your new book, of course, we're going to talk about it, Let Me Lie. But we're not actually going to talk too much about it because I think people should go into this book cold. I don't want to tell the whole story, but we will tell a little bit. But the important thing, I think, in milestones in your life is that you won the Theakston Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year Award in 2016. Now, Americans aren't as familiar with that award, but it is important because, in a way, it's sort of a People's Choice Award because the people get to vote on it, too.
They do, yeah. It's a big award in the UK. And, in fact, I Let You Go won that and another prize in France for in best international novel. So I feel very lucky that people have enjoyed my book so much. And actually, the Theakston one in the UK was the one where J.K. Rowling was also shortlisted, and so winning that one and beating J.K. Rowling was the only time that my children have thought that what I do is cool. Up until then, it was all very boring for them.
But you beat J.K. Rowling. That must have given you such a thrill. Have you met her so that you could... No, you didn't want to laugh.
I haven't met her, no. She sent me a very lovely Twitter message when I won, saying, well deserved, which I thought was lovely. But no, I haven't had the pleasure of meeting her.
Well, it was well deserved, because I will tell you, it is much better than what she wrote under Robert Galbraith. It's amazing. And of course, we have to tell people Lee Child won that same award back in 2011. And so it's an important award. And as I said, I love it because having, you know, lived in England, I know the importance of the award. And I like it because of the influence of the people, the readers, those people who just love your books. I don't know even where to start because people do love your books. And your first book, I Let You Go. You know, I have to ask this because, you know, this is my program is called A Program for Writers and Those Who Dream of Writing. When you were a police officer, were you dreaming of writing?
Not all the time. I dreamt of writing before I joined the police when I was much, much younger. But it just didn't feel like a job that normal people did. I couldn't see it presented to me as a job option. And so I just put it to one side, and it was something I did just for me. And then, to be honest, it wasn't until after I had children and I started blogging. And nowadays, you know, everyone has a blog. But back then, so I started blogging in 2008. And actually, there weren't that many blogs around, and so it was quite easy to build an audience, and I really started to find my voice and remember what I'd loved about writing. And so it sort of stemmed from there.
And, of course, it was it's a great background for an author because you use all that police procedure so beautifully in your books, which makes you unusual for a lot of crime fiction, which often gets things inaccurate. You are... spot on.
It certainly makes life a lot easier to be able to write authentically about investigations and procedure. But what's more useful is the observation that I was able to carry out during those 12 years, all those people from all those different backgrounds, from, you know, rich houses, poor houses, no houses, dealing with all sorts of issues, drugs, alcoholism, poverty, those were all people that I wouldn't have met if I hadn't joined the police. And it is very rich territory for any kind of writer, not just a crime writer.
Exactly. And I always say there are so many young people who do come out of university and they want to start writing, but they haven't lived. And you can tell, I can immediately spot a book by an author who hasn't actually lived that life, who doesn't have that authenticity that you have.
I wouldn't have been half the writer I am now if I had tried to make a living from writing at 21.
Well, you know, the new book is Let Me Lie. And I just have to tell my listeners, just read the book. I hate when they give too much away. In the beginning, like in Amazon, where they start telling this. No. Pick up the book, open it up, and if you want a psychological thriller with an author who knows the how to do that slow reveal, this is the book. Because let's briefly tell essential.
I can give you just sort of the setup.
That's it.
So Let Me Lie is standalone, so you don't need to have read my other books. It's narrated partly by a woman called Anna, who's a new mum, whose parents took their own lives a year previously. And Anna has always struggled to believe that her parents would do this. She's always wondered if someone else was involved. And when we join Anna, it's on the anniversary of her mum's death, and she receives an anonymous note which casts doubt over what happened to her parents.
So that's it. I'm not telling anything more. I'm not telling anything more. I mean, that's it. I don't care. People pick up this book, read it. Read it, because, you know, Claire, you are so good at this. And I'm thinking, you know, my listeners often ask me, how do you get a paragraph so perfect? How do you do it? Your actual physical, like, for example, there's a paragraph in chapter 35. It's Anna's chapter, and it starts off. I'm going to just read the beginning. So just to remind you, I haven't held Ella all evening. She has been passed around like a parcel, seemingly enjoying the attention and offering no resistance to the arms of friendly strangers. And it goes on. Now this, it's one paragraph, but in that one paragraph, you say so much. Did that paragraph just come out like that, or did you work on it?
That's a really interesting question. No one ever asks about the actual words, you know. They ask about story and characters. And I don't think very much, if I'm honest, about language and words. I think for me, that's the easy bit. I occasionally will replace a word. It's almost more like writing poetry than writing prose, because actually what I'm looking for is the way the words scan. And so that's when I'll change them, is because actually I want something that's two syllables there and not three, or I want something that's punchier or that has slightly more imagery than what I've had before. So that's the sort of thing that comes in a third draft, maybe, or maybe even at the copy edit stage. But at the first draft, the language pretty much, you know, it just comes out. What I'm thinking of more at that stage is pace and plot and character.
Well, there are so many examples in your book where a paragraph, just one little paragraph like that, you're talking here about a cocktail party and how you just, like, almost by word, it just fill us with anticipation, and you give us that setting so we feel like we're at that cocktail party. We watch the baby being handed around, and it is absolutely perfection.
Well, thank you very, very much. I'm flattered indeed.
Well, you know, as I said, it is, writing is a craft, and you certainly, I don't know, of course, with the first book, it was perfect. So how did it happen that you just sat down and wrote so well?
Well, do you know, it didn't happen, you know, straight off, and it certainly wasn't perfect. I think we gloss over the role of editors a little bit too much. I've got an amazing editor who points me in the right direction, who, you know, reins me back in if I get a bit too self-indulgent with words. And so that's brilliant. When I wrote that first book, I poured in so much of myself. I had I lost a child when he was a baby, and it remains the single most horrific thing that's ever happened to me. And in that first novel, where it's a novel about a character who is grieving, and so it was easier, I suppose, both easy and difficult, to draw on those experiences and just sort of let the words take shape on the page. And I think it was a really good good first novel to write for me. You know, it was well placed. It was looking at themes that I understood and that I had first hand experience of, and so that then gave me confidence in my second and third books to move away from my own frame of reference. But we're learning all the time. I mean, I look back at that first book now, and there's lots that I would change. You know, not least to do with the language and the dialogue that feels. I feel like I've improved anyway.
Well, you know, I came to you in a roundabout way because the first one I read was. Well, actually, not read, was I See You. I got the Audible version. And now, I don't normally do an Audible version, but for some reason, I got it, and I listened to it, and I thought, oh, my goodness, this is fantastic. So then I read the book, and then I realized, of course, that you're brilliant. And so then I went to I Let You Go. And so I was so thrilled when the new book came out because, again, as I said, Let Me Lie, which is the new book, is so wonderful from the point of view of all the twists and turns and the unexpected and how you do this slow reveal. I love that. If you want a suspense book, if you want a psychological thriller, you need that slowness. You don't want everything thrown at you right in the beginning. And so it's perfectly paced.
Thank you very much. No, they're very. So I love reading psychological thrillers, and they are. You're absolutely right. They are very different breed of books to crime thrillers, or even to traditional police procedurals. They are much more about the fear of what is going to happen, rather than your standard crime novel, where you know it starts off with a body, and the book is about who did it. And they're books that I love to read. I've loved them. So you talked about Jane Austen earlier. My favourite author, when I was growing up, was Daphne du Maurier, and her book Rebecca was the first psychological drama that I had read, and remains my favourite book to this day.
Well, you know, that's one of the important things that I tell authors. You know, it's so important that you read well. And that you really have this, all of this knowledge in the back of your mind. So if you've read Austen or Demure, you have a solid knowledge of good writing.
Absolutely, yeah, and a real mix of a mix of genres and a mix of classics and contemporary stuff. A writer needs to be reading all the time.
Now, when you started writing and you sat down and you realized that, boy, I can tell a story here. Did you go back and did you ever study writing? You know,
no, I didn't study it, but I can tell you the exact moment where I thought that actually maybe I could tell a story, and it was when I was blogging. And so up until that point, I'd only ever had feedback from people who had a vested interest, you know, my mom, my teacher, those sorts of people. And I wrote a blog post about postnatal depression, which is something I had been through with my children. And I received an email from a woman in Australia, and she said, that she had been trying for 5 weeks to put into words how she was feeling after the birth of her child, and that she hadn't been able to talk to her husband or a doctor or anyone. And she said, I read your blog post and I printed it out and I gave it to my husband because that is how I feel. And finally, I feel like I can talk about it. And it was a tremendously moving email from her and a real turning point for me, because it made me understand the real power of words, and that if we choose the right ones, we can communicate with people on such a profound level. And so it was a sort of turning point, because I began from that point on to write with other people in mind, with people that I didn't know, you know, with an audience in mind.
Well, I do want to mention there is, you know, one character in the new book that is really, really wonderful. And why I mention it is, most people, when they're writing about police officers, and they haven't been a police officer, they don't quite get it. And so tell us, just, we're not going to tell about the story, just tell us about the police officer in your book and why he's so good.
Oh, I love him so much.
I do too.
So,
as a matter of fact, I just want to say, in my mind, I want you to go back 20 years and write a whole book
too.
About him. And so we can know more about him, because I love him.
I absolutely want to do that. Okay, so Murray is a retired police officer. He's done 30 years in the police. He's been a detective for most of that time. He's very experienced, very knowledgeable. And because of the young age, relatively young age he was when he retired, he came back to the police to work as a civilian. And so he's working on the desk of the police station. And he's been married for 40 years to Sarah, who is a very funny, vivid, colourful woman who happens to have borderline personality disorder, which has seen her in and out of hospital for all of her life, and so for all of their marriage. And I really enjoyed writing about them. I liked writing about a strong relationship that has survived difficult times. I liked writing about a man who is essentially the main carer for a woman who has mental health problems. And I found it very, very difficult to say goodbye to him. And I've never wanted to write a series. I've never felt compelled to return to a character. But he is the one person who could potentially make me write a series.
Well, I agree.
There's so much more I want to know about him.
That's exactly how I felt. I'm reading the book and I say, oh my goodness, she's got a character here that she can write a whole series about. Because it is exactly that. He's so rich. There's so much that you want to know about him. So I can see you easily turning him into a series. And I think people would enjoy it, because I like the interaction between them. I like that she has, although with mental difficulties, she can still see very clearly sometimes. And so you have a winner there, I think, that in that character.
Well, watch this space.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It has been a joy to talk to you. I hope that you'll come back again soon. Which one of the books has been picked up by Hollywood yet?
Oh, well, none of them yet. So, hey, if Hollywood's listening, you know where to find me.
Well, they're all three of them. I would make a movie out of all three of them in an instant, because they are wonderful. And again, I want to thank you, and I want people, listen, this is important. Get Let Me Lie. Don't read anything else. Just go in cold, and it'll warm you up pretty fast.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you again for joining me. It's always wonderful to talk to somebody from England, because I wish I still owned my cottage in Sonning. I paid £19,000 for it.
You did not? Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
That's incredible.
Yes. Can you imagine?
Yeah, that's worth it. A bit more now.
Quite a bit. I hate myself when I think that I sold it. Anyway, it was wonderful to talk to you. And again, thank you so much for this wonderful book, Let Me Lie. Bye-bye now. Okay. Wow, she's nice. As I said, I've been to Chipping Norton many times. They had a wonderful, they have several wonderful Indian restaurants in Chipping Norton, which is north of Oxford. So it was just wonderful to talk to her, and I hope that you'll get this book. And as a matter of fact, the Audible version of I See You is one of the best Audible I have listened to. It's a really fantastic book. And I hope that you'll get that, too. Meanwhile, again, reminding you, you have only a few days to enter the contest for Writer's Digest. If you've written a book, submit it. Why not? You might win. You might win $8,000. Wouldn't that be fantastic? And get a trip to New York. And also, what was I going to say about... Oh, I started to talk about being careful about some of the information that is coming to authors all the time about different things that they are trying to sell you. And I really hope that you will understand, as I mentioned, now she has three books, three bestsellers, and she hasn't been contacted by Hollywood yet. She will be. I'm sure we will see all of these as films in the future. But, you know, I talked to JoJo Moyes, remember, and she, you know, it came along. After a while, if you have a best-selling book, Hollywood will pay attention. But there's no easy way to get into Hollywood. It is not ever easy, even for a best-selling author. So don't fall for any con jobs or scams where they tell you that if you pay them so much money, they're going to get your book in front of people in Hollywood, because they won't do it. And it's just a scam. And I'm really sorry to see so many authors getting these endless, I mean, every day, two or three emails. So just put them in scam. As a matter of fact, put them in scam so that people get reported for this kind of thing, because there is no way that Hollywood will pay attention to you through one of these things. So that's another thing. Now, also, again, I'm going to remind you, I know that, you know, Facebook is in a trouble today, but it will be back. And so if you would go to Facebook and like me and go to my webpage, and you can hear the archives of my programs there. Also send me messages about the books you like, the authors you want me to invite onto the program, and I will be happy to do so. And meanwhile, remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them in an audible book or in a film, a real film, not a scam. And say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. And thank you, and bye-bye. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him, and bye-bye for now.